She hadn't expected assignment with so little warning. There wasn't any time to waste. She ran downstairs to the bathing room. The last thing she wanted to do was give Kirill an impression of carelessness or incompetence. A good hot bath did a great deal to revitalize her. A dose of willow bark tea took care of the ache in her head. She couldn't do much for the half-cloudy feeling of her mind, but she hoped that being aware that she wasn't quite at her best would compensate for that. Rather than take the time for a full meal, she begged cheese, bread, and fruit from Miro. She was far too keyed up to eat much anyway. This would be the first time that she would meet with Kirill as an equal. Up until now, even though she had her whites, it had still been very much a teacher-student relationship. She took a few moments of precious time to consult with Roland before seeking Kirill. It was frustrating not to be able to speak with him in words, but simply mind-touching with him gave her an added measure of calmness. He reassured her that Kirill would never have expected her to report any earlier than this, and prevented her from changing at the last minute into one of her formal uniforms. And beneath it all was the solidity of knowing that he stood ready to help her if she truly found herself out of her depth on this assignment. Feeling a good bit more confident, she skipped down the tower steps and entered the palace proper. A few moments later, she had made her way to the administrative area. She paused outside the door of the records room, which served as Kirill's office, for a moment to order her mind and calm herself. She pulled the doeskin tunic straight, smoothed her hair, took a deep breath, knocked once, and entered. The records room was as neat as Dean Elkarth's office was cluttered. Sun streamed in through the two windows that looked out into the gardens on the west side of the building. Both of them were wide open, and flower scent wafted in through them. The room was crammed as full of bookshelves as it was possible to be. Kirill's desk stood just under one of the two windows, to take full advantage of the light. Kirill himself was leaning in the window frame, absently watching courtiers stroll in the gardens, and obviously waiting for her. She noticed something anomalous on his desk as he turned from the window to greet her. A quiverful of white arrows. "Sir," she said softly, and he turned to smile greeting at her. Kirill was pleased to see that Talia was looking alert and ready for practically anything. In the past few weeks of working with her, he had come to truly believe all that her collegium teachers had claimed for her. The Queen's Own was always an outstanding person among heralds, but Talia bid fair to be outstanding among the ranks of her own kind. He could not for a moment fathom why her reputation, even among her fellow heralds, was one of being a sweet but somewhat simple creature. He wasn't altogether certain that he would have been able to manage the feat of memorizing all the kingdom's familial devices and titles in the 3 weeks she'd taken. Perhaps it was because she was so shy, even yet, and seldom spoke without first being spoken to. Perhaps it was because of her ability with children in general, and the heir in particular. A strong maternal instinct was not necessarily coupled in anyone's mind with a high intellectual level. Then again, there weren't too many even among the heralds who had been her teachers who had seen the real Talia. She had not allowed very many of them to come within arm's length, as it were. Kirill was just sorry he had had so little time for her, and he sometimes worried a little about the strange gift of hers. Empathy that strong, and having seen her exert herself, he knew it was very strong, was far more the gift of healers. He had been relieved when she'd begun spending so much time with the healers. They would know how to train her properly, if anybody would. If he had only had the time, if Ilsa hadn't been killed. But Talia seemed to have everything perfectly under control, and if even her own peers tended to underestimate her, that surely wasn't going to harm her any. Perhaps, though, that tendency to dismiss her lightly was not altogether a bad thing. Kirill had been dealing with court and counsel on a daily basis for something like 20 years, and being underestimated could be a potent and very useful weapon. People might not see past the guileless eyes and tend to let their tongues run on longer leads in her presence. No, that reputation of hers might well be a very good thing for all of them. Certainly the disturbing rumors he'd heard lately about her would not survive much longer if people began comparing the tales of machinations with her reputation as a sweet and uncomplicated innocent. "Sit, sit," he waved at a chair, taking one himself. "You look none the worse for your late night. I remember my first Herald's revel. I thought my hangover was going to last for the next week. I trust you enjoyed yourself?" He smiled again as she nodded shyly. "It's the first chance I had to hear you sing. Jadis used to make us all curious, boasting about your abilities. He was certainly right about you. Last night, to tell the truth, I've heard bards that didn't give performances that moving. You're as good as Jadis claimed. Maybe better." She blushed, and he chuckled. "Well, that's neither here nor there. I am very sorry about all the hurry, but we don't like to leave border sectors without a herald for very long. In this case, it's not that there's potential for trouble, but that the people of the sector feel isolated enough as it is, particularly in winter. They need to know that they're as important to the life of this kingdom as the capital sector itself." He regarded her steadily. Her answer to his speech would tell him a great deal. The eyes that met his squarely held faint surprise. I thought there was always potential for trouble in a border sector, sir," Talia ventured. "There are raiders, bandits, lots of problems even if the people themselves never cause them."
"In the general run of things, that's true, but the border in this sector runs through the Forest of Sorrows, and that's no small protection."
"Then the tale of Vanyl's curse is true?" Talia was amazed. "Sorrows does protect the kingdom, but how?"
"I wish I knew," Kirill replied, musing half to himself.
"They knew things, those old ones, that we've forgotten or lost. They had magic then, real magic, and not our mind magic.
The truth spell is just about all we have left of that. Vanyl's curse is as strong in Sorrows as the day he cast it with his dying breath. Nothing that intends ill to this kingdom or the people in it lives more than 5 minutes there. I have seen some of the results with my own eyes. I used to ride Northern myself back in the days when I was still riding circuits and not Seneschal's herald. I've seen bandits impaled on branches as if on thrown spears. I've seen outlaws who starved to death, buried to their waist in rock-hard earth, as if it opened beneath their feet, then closed on them like a trap. What's more, and this is what was more frightening than the other things, I've seen barbarian raiders, dead without a mark on them, but their faces twisted into an expression of complete and utter terror. I don't know what it was that happened to them, but my guess is that they were truly frightened to death."
Talia shook her head wonderingly. "It's hard to believe. How can a curse know someone's intent?"
"I can't explain it, and neither can any of the old chronicles. It's true, nevertheless. You or I, or any of the people of the sector, can walk that forest totally without fear. A baby could walk through there totally unharmed, because even the forest predators leave humans alone in Sorrows. Well, that's the only anomalous thing about the area. The religion is fairly ordinary. The people follow the lady as Astera of the stars and the god as Kernos of the northern lights. There's no anti-woman prejudice. In fact, because of Sorrows, we often have females riding circuit there alone. The herald you're replacing is a woman, in point of fact. You may know her. She was 2 year groups ahead of you, Destria."
"Destria? Heavens, she isn't badly hurt, is she? What happened?"
"The injury is fairly serious, but not life-threatening. She was trying to rescue half a dozen children during a flood. It's a hard land, Talia. That's the main problem with it, and broke both legs."
"Thank the goddess for companions."
"Amen to that. Without hers, she'd have lain in sleet-borne water for hours, probably died of exposure. No, Destria's Sophie managed to get not only her herald, but all the children to safety. All's well there, except for the injury. So, that's the gist of the situation, and as I said, I apologize for the short notice. I hope you don't mind too much."
"Not at all, sir," Talia replied. "After all, I had even less notice when I was chosen, didn't I?"
"Good for you," Kirill chuckled. "Well now, We come to the reason why I asked you to come here, instead of meeting you for lunch or asking you to meet with both Chris and myself to be told about this. I'm sure you realized a long time ago that there were things we wouldn't teach you until you got your wines. What I'm about to show you is the best-kept secret of the heraldic circle. Haven't you ever wondered why all heralds are required to become archers?
I never thought about it, she confessed, looking puzzled. It does seem a little odd, now that you mention it. We don't fight with the royal archers in battle. When we do fight, it's mostly sword or hand-to-hand. We usually don't have to hunt to feed ourselves riding circuit. We carry supplies or depend on the shelters. So why do we have to learn bow?
So that you have an excuse to carry arrows wherever you go, Carol replied. Not everyone has the kind of mind-reach I have. Lady knows things would be much simpler if they did, because there are plenty of times when the ordinary means of passing information wouldn't do at all. We have to have a foolproof, unambiguous method of passing simple messages, but it has to be impervious to tampering. That's why the Arrow Code was developed, and thus far no one has broken it. And it all starts with this.
With skillful and practiced fingers, he carefully broke barbs from the fletchings of a plain white arrow he pulled from the quiver. Talia could see that he was being very precise about which barbs he broke from which fletchings. Yet when he was through, it looked as if the arrow had simply been handled too roughly. "So that's why all our arrows are fletched with mudgannet feathers," Talia said, enlightened.
"Right. They're nowhere near as suitable as goose, but the barbs are so thick, heavy and regular, it's possible to have the fletching on every arrow we carry absolutely identical, and it's possible to literally count barbs for the code. Now, this is my pattern. It's registered here among the secret records, and even there, it's in an encrypted form for added security. Outside of those records, only four people know it. The Queen, the Seneschal, Elkarth and Terran, who used to be my partner. Only the Queen, the Seneschal, and Elkarth know how to translate the ciphers we've written the patterns in besides myself. When your internship is over, you'll be given the encryption key as part of what you need to know as Queen's Own. Only two people know every pattern by heart, myself and Elkarth. Now you know why one of the primary prerequisites of both our jobs is a perfect memory."
Talia smiled and bit her lip to keep from chuckling.
"This pattern identifies the message carried by the color of the banding on the arrow as coming from me and no one else. Now,"
he took a second arrow from the quiver and broke the barbs in a second pattern,
"this is your pattern. When I'm satisfied that you can reproduce it in the dark and behind your back, I'll give you a general idea of the rest of the code."
She was slightly nonplussed to discover that Kirill meant that literally. It took several hours before she could perform that simple task without seeing the arrow she was working on, and without truly thinking about it, with a speed and accuracy that contented him. Meanwhile, the sun crept across Kirill's desk, and her stomach began reminding her that it had been a long time since her last real meal. Finally, Kirill pronounced her competent, and allowed her to give her tired fingers a rest while he explained the remainder of the code to her.
"The rest of it," he told her, "is a bit more complicated, although we've done our best to make the colors mnemonic to the message. Chris will drill you on the full code on your way to your sector. But in general, this is what the simple banding of one color means. White means there's nothing wrong. All is well. Come ahead. It's usually used just to identify that there's another herald about and who it is. Green calls for a healer to be sent. Purple for a priest. Gray for another herald. Brown tells the receiver to watch for a message. There's trouble, not serious, but something that requires elaboration and something that may delay the herald sending it in keeping his schedule. Blue means treachery. Yellow calls for military aid. The number of yellow bands on the arrows tells how many units. And if you send every yellow-ringed arrow you've got, and we know exactly how many you have, we know to send the entire army. Red means great danger. Come with all speed. Then there's black."
He paused, his eyes holding Talia's.
"I pray to heaven that you never have to send a black arrow, Talia."
Sending any black-ringed arrow
means there's been or will be death or catastrophe. And there's a variant on the code for black you should also know now rather than later. The black arrow intact, except for the fletching pattern, means total disaster, help or rescue needed. Break the arrow, send the pieces, and it reads, disaster, all hope gone, do not attempt rescue. Remove the head, and it means that the one whose pattern is in the fletching is dead. The broken arrow, the headless arrow, those can actually be of any color, so long as the fletching pattern's there. Those are the two we'll always understand, and the ones we never want to see. Talia felt a peculiar chill thread her backbone, and suddenly the hot, sunny day seemed unaccountably gray and chill. She shook off the feeling and repeated Kirill's words back to him verbatim.
"That's all there is," he said, satisfied. "You're as well prepared as any of us is for his first assignment, and you're one of the best heralds the Collegium has ever turned out. You ought to do just fine, even though this is going to be a tough assignment. Good luck to you, Talia. I look forward to seeing you in another year and a half."
She took her leave of him, and despite her hunger, decided it would be a good idea to hunt up Chris. The first place she looked for him, given the situation, was the tack shed. After all, he was only just in from field work. His first move should be to see that needed repairs had already been made to his companion's gear. That was exactly where he was, in company with Dirk, checking over his harness and tack. As alert as a wild thing to any hint of movement, Dirk was the first to notice her.
"It's our songbird,"
he said genially, favoring her with one of those smiles that was almost an embrace.
"I expect you have the word, and Kirill's given you the code."
She nodded, feeling oddly shy, then searched for Roland's never-used traveling equipment. It was similar to the tack he'd worn when he'd found her, except that the bridle bells were removable and the saddle was a bit more complicated. Besides the usual girth, it had breast and rump bands like those on warrior saddles, a far larger number of the snaffles by which objects could be fastened to the skirting, and an arrangement of rings and straps that made it possible for a rider, ill, injured, or unconscious, perhaps, to be belted securely into a seat. Talia rarely ever bothered with saddle or bridle around the Collegium, but she knew from experience, both her own and Roland's, that it would mean a great deal in the way of comfort on a ride of more than an hour, for both of them, for her to use the saddle. And as her near-fatal escapade in the river had shown, the otherwise useless reins on the bridle had other functions than guiding her companion. Had Roland been wearing his bridle, she could have twined her arms in the reins and let him tow her to shore, for instance.
"Everything in good order?"
Chris asked. She nodded an affirmative. Feeling awkward and tongue-tied now that she was less than 24 hours away from a long journey spent mostly in his company.
"Chris and I haven't taken care of requisitioning your supplies yet,"
Dirk said, giving her an encouraging, lopsided grin, as if he sensed how she was feeling.
"We were waiting for you to catch up with us."
"We?" Chris lifted an eyebrow at his partner.
"What's this we all about? She happens to be my trainee, you know." "And who's the one who can't ever remember how many furlongs it is to his sector, and whether or not you need high-energy rations, or even where he's going half the time?" "Your guess is as good as mine. I don't know of anybody answering that description."
Chris grinned. Dirk heaved a heavy sigh.
"No gratitude, that's what it is. All right, sieve-head. Let's you and your trainee get over to the quartermaster and show her how it's done."
They arranged themselves with Talia walking between them, and strolled out of the Collegium area of the palace to the area reserved for the guard. That is, they strolled. Talia had to stretch her legs no small amount to keep up with them. All the time she was constantly aware of the little, warm, sidelong glances Dirk kept throwing at her when he thought she wasn't watching. She wasn't used to being under such intense scrutiny, and it made her a little... not uneasy, precisely. Unsettled was perhaps the better word. Like the heralds, the guard had their own area of the palace, although they had nothing that was quite like the Collegium,
They did have a training center and a communal barracks, as well as officers' quarters, and they maintained a number of small rooms as offices. Since the needs of the heralds and the guard were quite similar in some areas of supply, the quartermaster of the guard also dispensed initial supplies to outbound heralds. Any other supplies were taken care of at special resupply stations in the field. The offices of the guard were entered by a door directly under the shadow of the wall that encircled the entire palace collegium complex. There were a dozen or more officers seated at desks literally crammed together in the relatively small room, all busy with piles of paperwork. But Chris and Dirk seemed to know exactly where they were going. Talia followed as they threaded their way through the maze, while the officers, whose work they inadvertently disturbed, gave them either glares or friendly winks. Their goal was a desk at the very rear, whose occupant, a grizzled old veteran, looked rather out of place among the younger, obviously town-bred officers. He seemed to be hard at his paperwork, but looked up and grinned broadly at the sight of them.
"What? You tired of our faces already?" he jeered. "Or that you've got somebody's daddy 'twould like to see if heralds bleed red?"
"Neither, you old pirate," Chris replied. "We've got a gap to fill up north, and Kirill, in his infinite wisdom, has decreed that we're best suited to fill it."
The man's face grew serious.
"I didn't hear the bell."
"Relax, Leverus, it wasn't fatal,"
Dirk assured him.
"A pair of broken legs, or so I'm told. Talia, this is Leverus. He's the quartermaster of the guard, and as such, those of us on circuit see a lot of him."
The wizened man stood, took her hand like a courtier, and bowed gracefully over it.
"'Tis a pleasure,"
he said gravely, while Talia blushed.
"And the privilege. Ye be queen's own, I'm thinking."
"Absolutely right," Chris said, corners of his mouth twitching. "She's my internee."
"Oh, so?"
Leverus let go of Talia's hand, rested both hands on his hips, and gave him a stern look.
"Ye'll not be trying any of your seducing tricks on her, my lad, or if I come to hear of it."
Now it was Chris's turn to blush, and Dirk's to hide a grin. Talia decided to come to his rescue. "Herald Kirill surely wouldn't have assigned us together if he thought there was any harm in the pairing," she pointed out. "And this is duty, not a pleasure jaunt."
"Well, and that's true,"
he admitted reluctantly, seating himself again.
"So, what sector?"
"North Border Sorrows too," Chris told him. "And since we won't be meeting the outgoing herald, we'll need the whole kit."
"By tomorrow, I suppose. And you'll be wanting the special rations. You might give a man some morning next time,"
he grumbled, but there was a twinkle in his eye.
"Sure, Leverus. We'll make certain to schedule our broken legs from now on, and make certain it's convenient for you."
"See that you do, then."
He chuckled, then pulled out a half-dozen forms, and had Chris and Talia sign them all. That done, he shooed them out the way they had come.
"That's all there is to it,"
Chris said, as they returned to the collegium side. "They'll have everything we'll need ready for us in the morning."
"Provided Herald Sluggard can be persuaded to rise that early," Dirk grinned. "Now that you've checked over your harness, all you need to do is pack your personal things," Chris continued, ignoring him. "Keep in mind that where we're going it gets cold sooner than here, stays that way for longer, and the cold is more intense. The leaves are already falling up there, though they've just started to turn here. We'll plan on staying mostly in way stations near the villages. We won't want to get too far from other people if we can help it."
"Nevertheless," Dirk warned both of them, "you'd better also plan on having to spend several nights alone in the wilderness. I lived in that area. You didn't. The villages are far apart, and winter storms can spring up out of nowhere. You may get caught without a way station near, so pack the emergency supplies. If you don't use them, there's no harm done, but if you need them, you'll be glad you have them. Plan for the worst possible snow you've ever seen. Then overplan."
"Yes, oh Greybeard,"
Chris made a face at him.
"Holy stars, Dirk. I visited with your family up there often enough. The way you're fussing, you'd think both of us were green as grass and totally untrained. Talia's no high-born, fragile flower. She's a borderer, too, even if she's from farther south than you." "Well,
Better I should remind you needlessly. Stow it and rope it down, Grantha. We'll be fine. Anyone would think you're my keeper, not my partner.
Now Chris cast a sly, sidelong glance at Talia, who was feeling distinctly uncomfortable. Or is it someone else you're worrying about? From the surprise on Chris's face, even he hadn't expected the blush that reddened Dirk's ears.
Look, Dirk said hastily, I just don't want you two to get into any trouble. You owe me for too many lost bets, and I'd rather not have to try to collect from your lord father. Is there anything else you'd like advice for, Talia?
No, she stammered. I don't think so, anyway. I thank you both. I'd better get back to my quarters and pack.
Don't forget, take nothing but whites, Dirk called after her. You're on duty every minute in the field, and nothing fancy. It'll only get ruined.
He needn't have said that about nothing fancy, she thought a little resentfully. After all, I'm not some silly town-bred chit. And then she wondered for a fleeting instant why his good opinion of her should seem so important. Dismissing the thought from her mind, she ran back up the tower stairs and ransacked her wardrobe, laying everything white she could find on the bed. That way she wouldn't overlook a tunic or other article that she might find herself in need of out in the field. She packed nothing but the doeskin, with the summer and winter changes both, but she packed every stitch of those she had. Though from the way Dirk talks, she thought wryly, you'd think it never got warm up there. She added a repair kit for leather and one for harness, and then for good measure added a sealed pot of glue, just in case. There'd been times enough back on the holding when she was on sheep watch that she'd needed a pot of glue and not had one to hand. She packed her sewing kit and a brick of hard, concentrated soap, the special kind that you needed for use on whites to keep them pristine, just in case it ever became necessary to do her own repairs and cleaning of her clothing. Certainly the village laundry people normally tended those jobs, but you never knew. She added a small metal traveling lamp and extra wicks, because she'd never seen a lamp in the way stations, and if they stayed more than one night, lamplight was easier on the eyes than firelight. Then her personal gear, her weapons, a precious book or two, some writing supplies. Her bedroll was next, and all the extra blankets she could find. With them, two extra towels besides the others she carried, and a pair of thick sheepskin slippers. Roland's gear was all with his tack, but just the same she packed a vial of ferrous oil. He liked it. It was good for his hooves and coat and kept the insects away. Even when she'd packed everything as compactly as she could, it still bulked distressingly large. She stared at the clumsy packs in near despair, trying to think of something she dared leave behind. Chris would surely think she was an idiot for wanting to bring all this stuff.
Good packing job, Karen said from the open door behind her. I intended to come up here and help you cut down on the flotsam, but it looks like I'm not needed.
Is that meant ironically or seriously? Talia asked, turning to greet the more experienced herald with relief.
Oh, seriously. My counselor made me repack 3 times for my interning trip, and I never did get my packs down that small. I kept thinking of things I was sure I'd miss. Know what? I ended up sending most of them back here.
But how is Roland ever going to carry all this, the supply pack and me too?
Easy, he won't have to. You'll each have a pack beast, probably a mule. Well, maybe not. You're going north. They may give you chiras.
Didn't anybody tell you that? You're riding circuit, not carrying messages, so you don't need speed. You can easily hold your speed down to match your pack beasts without sacrificing anything.
Talia heaved a sigh of relief.
Nobody told me. Chris either assumed that I knew or left it out deliberately to keep me from overpacking.
Well, don't go crazy now that you know, Karen warned.
I won't. In fact, other than begging a couple more blankets and a pillow from supply, packing all 3 pairs of my boots, and adding a bit more in the way of towels and soap and the like, there's only one thing more I want to add.
Talia tucked her 3rd pair of boots into a pack, tied it shut, and turned to the hearth corner. There, where she'd left her last night, still in her carrying case, was my lady. She opened the case, detuned the strings for safety in traveling, and added her to the pile. Good notion,
Karen said. You may be snowbound at any time, and that'll keep you from tearing out each other's throats from boredom. Not only that, folks up there seldom see a bard except in summer. You'll be like gifts from the gods.
Karen, oh.
Talia suddenly had a lump in her throat. Now it came home to her. She was leaving. Leaving the only place that had ever felt like home. And the only friends she'd ever had.
I'll miss you.
Karen reached out and hugged her shoulders.
Don't you worry. You'll be fine. I know you will. Chris is a good lad, if a bit too conscious of his own good looks.
Little centaur, I'll miss you too, but don't you dare cry, she warned, caught between a chuckle and a tear,
or I'll start. Come on. We've just enough time to catch the end of supper, and you must be ready to chew harness.
Supper was rather subdued. Nearly everyone had long since eaten and gone, and of those that were left, Talia really knew only Karen well. Talia kept glancing around her, realizing how much she was going to miss this place that had been her first real home. She had expected that Karen would leave her afterward, but to her surprise, the older woman insisted that she come with her to Karen's rooms. She was even more surprised when Karen insisted Talia precede her through the door. Then she saw who was waiting for them there. Almost more people than would fit into the room. Elkarth, Sherry, Jerry, Skiff, Terran, even Albrick. Devon made a brilliant patch of green among the whites in his healer's robes. The students were well represented by Elspeth. Karen pushed her into the room from behind as she hesitated on the threshold.
You really didn't think we'd let you go without a proper goodbye, did you?
Skiff teased, as Talia stared in dumb amazement.
Besides, I know you. You were all set to mope away your last night here alone. Goose, well, we're not having any of that.
Since that was exactly what she'd expected to be doing, Talia blushed rose pink, then stuck her tongue out at him. Skiff, knowing very well how prone Talia was to isolating herself just when she needed others the most, had accosted Karen as soon as the news of Talia's assignment had gotten to him. The two of them had put their heads together and quickly put together this little fare-thee-well party, designed to keep her from falling into a last-minute melancholy. When Skiff saw the expression on Talia's face, as she'd realized what they'd done, he felt more than repaid for his effort. He did his level best the whole evening to project how much his little sister meant to him, knowing she'd pick it up. The warmth in her eyes made him feel that he'd at least begun to give her an honest return for the help she'd given him last night. In some ways, he was just as glad now that they'd never become lovers, for there was nothing that could have been more satisfying in the long run than the open, loving relationship they had instead. He had more than a suspicion that she felt the same.
So, songbird, how about a tune or three?
While it wasn't precisely as festive as the celebration the night before had been, everything had been geared to setting her mind at rest and making her feel confident about the morrow. Each of them, with the exception of Devon and Elspeth, had faced the same moment, and each knew some way to make the prospect a positive one. There was a great deal of laughter, plenty of absurd stories, and a palpable aura of caring. They sent her off to bed in good time to get a full night's sleep, and she left with a smile on her face. Chris answered the tap on his door late that evening, expecting to see Dirk. In fact, he'd already gotten out a bottle of wine and two glasses, figuring that his partner wouldn't let the evening pass without coming by for a farewell drink and chat. He got a fair shock to find his uncle, the counselor Lord Orthalan, standing in the dim hallway instead. He managed to stammer out a surprised greeting, which Orthalan took as an invitation to enter. The silver-haired, velvet-robed noble wore a grave expression on his still handsome, square-jawed face. So Chris had more than a faint suspicion that his visit was not just to bid farewell to his nephew. He directed his uncle to the most comfortable chair in the room and supplied him with the glass of wine intended for Dirk before taking the chair opposite him. "Well, uncle?" he said, deciding he was too tired to dance diplomatically around the subject.
"What brings you here? I know it wasn't just to bid me a fond farewell."
Orthalan raised one eyebrow at his bluntness.
"I understand you have the new Queen's Own as your internee."
Chris shrugged.
It's no secret.
How well do you know her?
Not at all, he admitted. I've seen her twice, worked with her once. She seems nice enough, quite well balanced, all told. Her gift is an odd one, but
that is exactly what is worrying me.
Orthalyn all but pounced on the opening.
Her gift. From all anyone has been able to tell me, it is a very unusual one for a herald, much less the Queen's own. It seems to be one that the heralds themselves know very little about. And I'm not entirely happy that an inexperienced child should be in her position with a power so out of the ordinary.
Roland chose her,
Chris replied warily.
That should be proof enough that she's capable of handling it.
Yes, but emotions, it's such a volatile area. No black and white there, only grey. There are rumours in the court, such as, that she has fostered an unnatural dependence in the air. After all, the child is vulnerable to that sort of thing. It was her unnatural dependence on that foreign nurse, Hulda, that led to her nearly being disallowed in the first place. And there are other rumours.
Chris bit back an angry retort. Best hear his uncle out.
Go on. That Talia has used her power to influence the council. You can imagine for yourself how easy that would be. If a counselor were wavering, it would be very easy to nudge his emotions, make him feel happier about one side or the other, or not even that, simply sense that he is wavering and use that knowledge to persuade him in a more ordinary fashion. By knowing how counselors stood, it would make it quite simple for her to manipulate them just by tone of voice. That's absurd. No herald would ever use her gift in any such fashion.
So I have maintained,
Orthalyn replied smoothly.
But the only others gifted with empathy are the healers. Healers put it to very specific and humanitarian use. There is no corresponding protocol of use among heralds and nephew. What if she truly were not aware she was using her abilities? These powers are not material properties one can weigh or measure or hold in one's hand. What if she were doing this sort of thing without even realizing it?
Chris felt as if he had been hit with a pail of cold water.
I suppose it's just barely possible. I don't think it's at all likely, but I can't dismiss the notion out of hand.
Orthalyn rose, a satisfied smile creasing his lips.
That is what I hoped you would tell me. I'm counting on you, nephew, to lay these phantoms of doubt to rest. You'll be with her night and day for the next 18 months, and I'm sure you will be able to tell me on your return that all these rumours are no more than smoke.
I'm sure I will, uncle,
Chris replied, letting him out, but not at all sure in his own mind. It was just false dawn when Tali awoke, and she dressed as quickly as she could, discovering that someone had left a breakfast tray for her outside her door. She had only just finished it when a guardsman tapped discreetly on the doorframe, explaining that he was there to help her carry her packs down. With his aid, she managed to get everything down to the tack shed in one trip. Bright light from oil lamps along the wall dazzled her eyes as she entered. Waiting in the very center was Roland. His harness was piled beside him. Next to him was a second companion stallion, and Talia could see Chris's legs behind him as she and the guard approached. Tethered beside the strange companion were two most unusual pack animals. Talia had never seen churras before except in pictures, for their heavy coats made summer at the Collegium far too uncomfortable for them. Rather than keep them there, the Circle had a northern farm where they were bred and stabled, and only brought them down on rare occasions like this. Had this been within the normal order of things, they would have taken mules from the Collegium stables for the first part of the journey. Then they would have met the herald they were replacing at the edge of her sector, and exchanged their mules for her churras. Talia discovered that pictures and descriptions were inadequate to convey the charm of the northern beasts. The churras were as tall at the shoulder as a horse, but a much longer neck put their heads on a level with the head of a human on horseback. Instead of hooves, they had dog-like clawed feet, except that the feet were almost round and far bigger than Talia would have expected from the overall size of the animal. Both churras were creamy white with black markings. One had a little cap-like spot on the top of its head, and a matching saddle marking on its back. The other had a collar of black fur that ran around its throat and down its chest. Their ears were large, resembling rabbit ears, but rounder, with tips that flopped over. Their ears were set on the tops of their skulls and faced forward. Their faces were vaguely rabbit-like. Their brown eyes were very large, gentle, and intelligent. When Talia approached them with her hand held out to them, they scrutinized her closely, then politely took turns waffling her palm. Chris was already halfway through his inspection of the beasts and their gear. "Kind of cute, aren't they? Anybody ever tell you how they managed to live through those blizzards? They've got 3 layers of fur," he said, bent over and adjusting the girth of the pack harness, half hidden by the churra's bulk. "The outermost is long and coarse and pretty much waterproof. Even frost won't form on it. The middle layer is shorter and not quite so coarse. The inner layer is what they shed every year. It's dense, very soft and fine, and is what does most of the work of keeping them warm. We'll have to groom them very carefully every night to keep all that fur from getting matted, or they'll lose the warming and waterproofing effect."
"Why are their feet so big?"
"To hold them up on the snow. They'll be able to walk on snow crusts that the companions will break right through."
He moved to the front of his and picked up its forefoot while it whiffled his hair.
"Look here. See all the hair between the toes? If you think their feet look big now, wait till they spread them out on snow. You'd think that hair wouldn't make any difference, but it does, like the webbing on snowshoes. I much prefer churras over mules in any kind of climate that they can tolerate. They've got sweet tempers, and they're really quite intelligent. If a mule balks, you can't tell half the time if he's being stubborn or if there's really something wrong. A churra never balks unless there's something wrong."
The churra next to Talia stretched out his neck and nudged her hand, obviously wanting to be petted. "How much can they carry?" she asked, complying by scratching behind the churra's ears. It sighed happily and closed its eyes in content.
"Almost half their own weight. As good or better than a mule. Well, look at the packs they're bringing now, and you can see."
Talia was astonished at the size of the pack the stable hands were loading on the churra she was scratching. It didn't seem the least bit uncomfortable. Chris looked it over, then eyed the packs Talia had brought down from her room.
"They've left enough leeway for you to load those on him as well, Talia. Don't worry, he's smart. If it's going to be more than he can carry, he'll just lie down until we lighten the load."
To her relief, the churra showed no sign of wanting to lie down after her packs had been strapped on top of the supplies. Chris saw to the distribution of the rest of the supplies and his own belongings, while Talia made sure the churra's harness was firm but comfortable, with nothing twisted or binding. She harnessed Roland herself, then double-checked her work and asked him in an undertone, "You don't mind traveling with these beasties, do you?" He seemed pleased that she had asked the question, but conveyed the impression that he was quite pleased with the pack beasts. Without words, Talia got the distinct impression that the churras, sporting those thick, warm coats, would be more than welcome company on cold winter nights. She fastened the lead rope of the churra to the back of Roland's saddle and mounted. Chris mounted a fraction of a second later.
"Ready?" he asked.
"As ready as any internee, I guess."
"Then let's go."
Chapter 4 Chris took the lead. They had to go single file in the city. Talia and Roland followed his churra out of the gates of the courtyard, past the collegium and palace buildings, gray and silent in the early morning light, then down the cobblestoned road to the iron gates leading to city streets themselves, the road she'd ridden up 5.5 years previously. She looked back over her shoulder for a last glimpse of the dear, familiar stone buildings, and wondered what she'd be like when she saw them again. The guard at the gate let them out. It was scarcely an hour until dawn, and the streets were not yet crowded.
They followed the long spiral outward, passing first through the residential areas that were nearest the palace. Huge buildings, belonging to the highest ranked of the nobly born, some nearly rivaling the size of Bardic or Healer's Collegium, though not that of the palace itself. Then crowded far more closely together, the homes of the rich, merchants and craftsmen and guild officials. Unlike the palace and the edifices of the nobles, which were the same gray granite as the city walls, these buildings were wooden. Since land within the walls was at a premium, they crowded so closely the eaves touched. And when there was a need to expand, the only direction to take was up, which sometimes produced some very strange results. Most of these houses had been constructed of iron oak, a wood nearly as tough and indestructible as steel. But that was where any similarity among them ended. They had been built to some highly individual styles, and often had been added to in years and styles varying wildly from the original. Had the spiraling main street not been wide enough for three carriages, it would never have gotten any sun. Riding through this district so early in the morning was rather like riding down a canyon with sides carved in the most fantastic of shapes. Talia had to fight to keep from giggling as she passed some of these houses, for Skiff, to keep his hand in, or so he claimed, had often paid uninvited visits to the upper stories of some of these places. He'd usually left unsigned notes to be found later, chiding the owners for their lack of security. That was one prank the provost marshal would never have forgiven him if it had been discovered. After the street took a sharp right-angle turn, the purely residential district came to an end. Now the lower stories of the buildings were devoted to shops and the workplaces of fine craftsmen, or offices, with an occasional expensive hostelry. The upper floors were comprised of apartments or lodgings. At this point they began encountering what little traffic there was this early in the morning. Nearly the only people about were the farmers who had brought their produce into market. For the only city folk moving were those who were buying fresh supplies for their inns. Talia and Chris were able to move at a brisk pace, not having to stop for traffic more than once or twice. The streets were so quiet at this hour that they were the chief sources of sound. The ringing of the companions' hooves, the chime of their bridle bells, and the click of the churra's claws on the cobblestones. It took them nearly an hour to reach the northern gate. The farther from the center of the city they went, the less wealth was displayed. There were no slums within the old city. Those were outside the city gates. Huddling against the walls as if in hopes that those sturdy stone structures might shelter them from the elements. It was in one such district that Skiff had grown up, the rather odd section along Exiles Road that led into the west. Talia had never been there. She had seldom been out of the old city, much less into the new. The one time she'd asked to be taken there, Skiff had turned white and refused. She'd never asked again. Nor would she go anywhere near that section this time, for Chris's chosen route led past the warehouses and the shipwrights, after crossing over the river just inside the old city walls and exiting through the North Point gate. Here there was no activity at all. Workers had not yet arrived, and deliveries to the warehouses had yet to be made. So once again they rode in silence, after a sleepy guardswoman waved them on their way. Beyond the gate, the road widened and changed from stone to that odd substance that wasn't stone and wasn't clay. Talia hadn't thought about it in years, but it occurred to her now to wonder just what it was that paved some of the roadways of this kingdom. "Kres," she called, and he motioned to her to ride up alongside him, now that they were out of the city. "What has this stuff?" she asked, pointing to the surface of the road. He shrugged.
"Another lost secret. Some of the roads leading to the capital are paved with it, a few all the way to the border, but any roads made later than Elspeth the Peacemaker's time are just packed gravel at best."
He saw she was looking about her with unconcealed curiosity.
"Haven't you ever been out of the city before?"
"Not very often since I was chosen," she replied, "and never in this direction."
"Didn't you even go back home for holidays?"
he asked, astonished.
My parents weren't exactly pleased with me, even, or perhaps especially, when they learned I was chosen, she replied dryly. Not to put too fine a point upon it, they disowned me. In whole terms, that means they denied the very fact of my existence. I spent all my holidays here with Jadis while he was still alive, then with Karen and Ilsa, or with Gaith, the housekeeper, and Miro, the Collegium cook.
You've been rather sheltered, then?
At the Collegium, yes. Except for the first year. Not at the Hold, though. Know anything about Holderkin?
Not much, Chris admitted. They seemed so dull, I'm afraid I've forgotten most of what I learned about them as a student.
Whether or not it's dull depends on whether you were born male or female. Holderkin are originally from Outkingdom, Carsey, if you're curious. They fled from religious persecution. Their religion is based on a dominating, ruling god and a passive, submissive goddess, and the Carsites are monotheistic. That was, oh, 2 generations ago. They are very secretive and very intent on maintaining their ways intact. Men have some choice in their lives. Women are given exactly 2 choices. Serve the goddess as a cloistered, isolated votary under a vow of silence, or marry. You make that choice at the mature age of 13, or thereabouts.
13?
Chris looked aghast. Hellfire, Chris, life is hard on the border. You ought to know that, with your partner being a borderer. There were raiders every winter I can remember. The land is stony and hard to farm. Holderkin don't believe in going to healers, so a lot of simple injuries and illnesses end in death. If you're not wedded by 15, you may not leave any offspring, and they need every work in hand they can get.
You sound like you enjoyed that kind of life, like you approve of it.
Chris was plainly astonished by her attitude. I hated it, she said flatly. I hated every minute that I didn't spend reading or daydreaming. Roland's choosing me was the only thing that saved me from a forced marriage with some stranger picked out by my father. I think that the way they confine themselves, their children, and most especially their minds, is something approaching a crime. But most of the older folk I knew seemed content, even happy, and I have no right to judge for them.
Fine, you won't judge for them, but what about others who are unhappy as you were, with no Roland to rescue them?
A good point. And fortunately for those would-be rebels, one Elkarth and Selene thought of after hearing my story. The Holder folk got their land grants on condition that they obey the Queen and the laws of this kingdom. Shortly after I arrived at the Collegium, Selene had a law passed through the council that heralds must be allowed free access to children at all times, in order that they can be certain that the children of this kingdom are properly educated in our laws, history, and traditions. Heralds whose gift is thought-sensing go right into the holdings now. Anyone willing to sacrifice family ties and standing as I did is free to leave with them, and they make sure the unhappy ones know this. The amazing thing to me is that there was very little objection to the practice after the initial outrage died down. I suppose the hold elders are only too pleased that their potential troublemakers are leaving on their own. Chris seemed a bit bemused.
I can't imagine why anyone would not want to leave conditions like that.
Talia shook her head sadly, remembering. It wasn't quite true that she hadn't gone back to the hold. She had, once, last year. She'd gone back in the hopes of rescuing her sister Vrissa, to discover Vriss had changed, changed past all recognition. Vriss was a first wife now, with status, and 3 underwives to rule. She'd regarded Talia as if she were a demon. When she thought Talia wasn't looking, she'd made holy signs against her. In point of fact, she looked and acted enough like Keldar, the first wife who'd done her best to break Talia's rebellious spirit, to have been Keldar's younger self. She not only didn't want rescue, she'd been horrified by the idea. "Cress, it's not my choice to make," she answered wearily. "It's theirs. All that I care about is that the ones like me now have the option I didn't have before I was chosen, to escape." Chris looked at her with curiosity.
Just when I think I have you neatly categorized, you say or do something that turns it all upside down again. I'd have bet that you'd have been willing to lead an army into the holds to free the women, given the chance.
Maybe when I didn't know as much about people as I do now, she sighed.
They rode on in silence. The sun rose on their right, turning the sky pink, rose, and blue, casting long shadows across their path from the buildings. Before long, they had passed beyond the edge of the new city, and there was nothing before them but the occasional farmhouse. Cows were gathering outside barns, lowing to be milked. Now they saw people working, and a light breeze carried to them the smell of cut grain and drying hay, and the sounds of birds and farm beasts.
"Tell me about yourself," Chris said finally. "When you're tired of talking, I'll tell you about me. Start with what it was like on the hold, before you were chosen."
"It's boring," she cautioned him.
"Maybe, but it's part of you. As your counselor, I need to know about you."
He did his best to keep his opinions to himself while she talked, but he frequently looked surprised by some of what she told him, and actually horrified once or twice. He had, she thought, a hard time conceiving of a culture so alien to his own, so confining and repressive. Talia herself spoke in a kind of detached tone. She felt very distant from the Holderkin and all they meant now. She could think of them without much animosity, as something foreign. It was noon when she finally grew tired of explaining Hold customs to Chris. She paused for a long drink from her waterskin, suddenly aware that her mouth was very dry, and said firmly, "I think I've talked enough."
"More than that, it's time to break for lunch," he replied. "While we keep to this pace, the churros can go on indefinitely, so whether or not we break depends on whether or not we want to take a rest from riding. How are you feeling?"
"Like I'd like to get off for a while," she admitted. "It's been a long, long time since I spent this many hours riding."
"I'm glad you said that."
His answering smile was completely ingenuous and quite charming.
"I'm not at all fond of eating in the saddle, unless there's no choice. As soon as I spot a place where we can water the churras and our companions, we'll take a rest."
They found a way station within the half hour. This one was watered by a well rather than a stream. They took turns hauling up enough water to satisfy the four-footed members of the party, then tethered the churras so that both companions and churras could graze for a bit while they ate their own lunch. They ate in silence, and Chris seemed to be in no great hurry to move on afterward. He lay back in the soft grass instead, thoughts evidently elsewhere, though he glanced over at Talia once or twice. Chris was worried, though he was taking pains not to show it. His uncle's words kept coming back to him, and he could not, in all conscience, dismiss them. He'd made a number of assumptions about his trainee, most of them based on her apparent youth and inexperience, and now what she'd told him seemed to indicate that she was anything but inexperienced and certainly was not the simple creature he'd pictured to himself. This child, no, woman. He began to wonder now if she'd ever had anything like a childhood, as he knew the meaning of the term, had been functionally the queen's own long before she ever attained her whites. But she was so tiny, and so guileless, and so very innocent-seeming that you forgot all about that, and tended to think of her as much younger than she really was. He didn't think any of that surface was a deliberate act, but he also couldn't tell what lay below the surface either. Was she capable of the kind of deliberate misuse of her gift that Ortholan had described?
"I've got to ask you a question," he said at last. "And please, I don't mean this as any kind of insult. There are some rather unpleasant rumors circulating the court, and I'd like to know the truth. Have you ever used your gift to influence Elspeth?"
Her reaction was far more violent than he would have expected.
"No!"
she shouted, sitting bolt upright and actually startling companions and churras into shying.
"How can you even think such a thing?"
Her eyes were hot with anger, her face as white as her uniform. He met that angry gaze as best he could, acutely aware of how still it was, of the grass under his hands, of the sun on his head.
"It's a rumor,
I told you, I have to know.
I have never, I would never, do anything like that to anyone. It's... the whole idea is perverted, she choked. Damn it, I knew there had to be some odd things being said about me. I mean, I could tell. People were acting very strangely when they thought I wasn't looking. But this, it's disgusting. Does Elspeth know about this?
Not so far as I know.
He broke off at the sudden, pained look she gave him. She rose to her feet abruptly.